This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producers Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about coal. The United States is more dependent today on coal than ever before. As a fuel, it does have some significant advantages. It's easy to ship. It's easy to store, it's easy to burn, and a lot of people would say, well, the main advantage of coal compared with other energy sources is that it is cheap. However, there are costs associated with our heavy reliance on coal, costs that we often ignore, including damage to the environment and the hazards that are faced by the people who dig the coal out of the earth. This morning, in this hour, we will look at some of the consequences of our reliance on coal as an energy source as we talk with Jeff Goodell. He is a journalist who's authored a book that was first published in June of 2006 and now is out in paper. Actually, it's been out about a year in paper, both published by Houghton Mifflin. His book is titled Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. He is also the author of a book titled Our Story, which is the story of a mine disaster that happened back in 2002. He's authored a couple of other books. He's also contributing editor at Rolling Stone and frequent contributor to The New York Times Magazine. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Goodell, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. I appreciate you being with us. Maybe I should say again, because you were good enough to spend some time talking with us. Last year, it was not long after the Sago disaster, and we talked a little bit particularly about the issue of mine safety, which is something I'm sure that we'll talk about again this morning, because it doesn't sound like things have changed very much over that time. One thing, I guess perhaps the place to start, one of the things that you mentioned early on in the book, something that I think will probably surprise people, given that in our discussion about energy, we spend so much time talking about oil and how much oil we use and where it comes from and how much it costs. And certainly, yeah, in the American economy, oil is very important as a transportation fuel. But if you take a look at where our energy comes from, I think most people will not realize just how important coal is.
No, I think that was even a big surprise to me when I started, looking into this book. I mean, coal is, generates 50% of the electricity in America. In a state like Illinois, it generates even more. And it's really crucial to keeping the lights on in our society today. And the question of how we will keep using coal, if we can keep using coal in a world that takes global warming seriously, is one of the most complicated energy questions of our time.
Mm-hmm. If you look at supplies of coal here, as I said, one of the things that we talk about a lot when it comes to oil is where it is and how much there is. If you ask a question about in the United States, how much coal we have and the potential for us to continue, let's set aside the environmental questions. If all we were going to say was how long could we continue to burn it at the rate that we're doing, what would the answer to that be?
Well, first of all, I just would like to qualify it a little bit by saying that the idea that we can disassociate the environmental cost is a very complicated one, especially with coal, because it does require digging it out of the ground, and there's always huge environmental costs with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, from a strictly, numbers point of view, if we kept burning it at the rate we're burning it now, that is not increasing to use coal for liquid fuel or not increasing coal demand for rising electricity usage or population, about 250 years, which, sounds good, except that the question is, what would America look like after we'd mined all that coal out of the ground?
Yeah. Well, that's, perhaps, yes, I did say setting aside the environmental questions, and maybe that's just not In fact, you just can't do that. You can't set aside the environmental questions, those that are that result from simply extracting the coal in the first place,
right?
And then those that relate to burning the coal, and the fact that generally with our present technologies, we're continuing to put a lot of pollutants into the air that affect the global climate and also affect people's health. Let's talk about that for a second, just about what the consequences of burning coal mean in terms of the stuff that comes out of the smokestack and goes out into the air.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as most listeners might know, you know, coal air pollution from coal plants has been one of the major public health problems, you know, of the last really of the whole 20th century. The coal industry has gone a long way towards cleaning up the traditional pollutants of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. But still, you know, the American Lung Association studies have shown that about 26,000 people a year still die prematurely from the air pollution from coal-fired power plants, much of that from the particulate matter that comes out of the plants. And despite the fact that industry has made progress in building newer, cleaner plants from the traditional pollutant point of view, there's still a lot of old plants that were built in the 50s and 60s with no pollution controls that are spewing out large amounts of air pollution. And then there's the whole question of carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that causes global warming. And that, going forward, is the real challenge for coal.
Yeah. And if we talk about extraction, I suppose when people think about coal mining, they might well think about the kind of mine that where the miners get into an elevator and they go down deep into the earth. And if you walk over it on top of it, you're not going to see anything because it's underground. While that kind of mining, I suppose, still goes on, it seems that, in fact, more kind of extremely what we're seeing more and more is radical strip mining, the kind of thing that involves taking off the top of entire mountains to be able to get at coal. It's something that you can do. It's cheaper. It involves fewer people. Although here the environmental consequences are really, really dramatic.
Right. Yeah, the large strip mines have become an increasingly large percentage of the coal mining that goes on, partly or mostly because it's cheaper. And it's just simply cheaper to blow up a mountain and sort of remove the mountain from the coal than to try to tunnel in and dig the coal out of the mountain, and especially in Appalachia. And one of the reasons that this has become, you know, more and more popular is because of the rise of Wyoming coal. There's a lot of coal in Wyoming that's very easy to get at. It's very close to the surface. And so coal mines in Illinois and in, you know, West Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio and places like that are increasingly having to compete against this very, very cheap coal coming out of Wyoming. And so there's real pressure to do it as cheaply as possible.
Well, let's talk with Carl here. Well, rather than make them wait, we have someone on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. About 25 years ago, I happened to speak with an engineer professor at the University of Illinois, and his specialty was coal mining. And we talked. He had just gone to a conference, and we were talking in general. And in the conversation, he told me that the same corporations that control the oil companies also control the coal companies, and that sort of was news to me and tucked it away in the back of my mind, and here you are talking about coal, and I thought I would ask you that question, and what has your research shown in relationship to that question?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question, and that was certainly true 25 years ago. After the oil crisis of the 1970s, when oil prices went up, and oil companies looked to diversify, and a lot of them bought coal companies and coal mines and things like that. But most of them have divested those, have sold those off now. And in general, the coal mines are owned by companies that own just coal. There is not a lot of overlap with the oil industry right now in the coal mining part of the business. There is some now in the electricity generation part of the business, but not in the actual owning of the mines. Although that could change as if oil supplies in the Middle East become tighter, oil prices go up, and oil companies start looking for new sources of revenue.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, nearby community, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. You really can't get coal much closer to the surface than it is over here in Vermilion County in Illinois. Traditionally, it was exposed by the rivers that flowed through. And for years and years and years, strip mining started here and flourished here. And a lot of coal was moved from Vermilion County to Chicago to produce steel after the Second World War. And coal was a real big industry here. Now, the question I'm getting at here is that this coal could be very easily used in systems that could be moving towards a hydrogen economy, which they're thinking about doing in Tolono, south of Champaign, in what's called Future Gen, to produce not only electricity but also hydrogen in the process of extracting the energy from the coal. Now, do you have anything that you can discuss about the aspects of turning coal into a hydrogen economy and also sequestering the carbon that's produced back into the ground?
Mm-hmm. Well, those are all really good questions again. The question of how you make coal clean and essentially make coal work for a world that takes global warming seriously is what FutureGen is trying to do. FutureGen is a partnership with the Department of Energy with a number of public, with energy utilities and coal companies. It's a sort of government-funded advanced coal technology project. I'm all for, you know, I think this kind of basic research on this kind of stuff is really great and very important given our energy problems in America. But FutureGen itself, I think, is a long way off. I mean, I think that, you know, it's scheduled to be completed in 2013. at best, if it works, and there's not a great track record of these kind of big government projects working very well, you know, we're looking at the middle of, you know, 2025 or something before it becomes commercialized, if at all. That's a long time. And the difficulty is there's kinds of coal plants right now called coal gasification that Illinois is actually quite progressive about pushing that I think are a much more important technology in the short term. And they, too, can capture the carbon dioxide before the coal is burned, before the electricity is generated. And it can be sequestered underground in 2,000 feet or so underground in deep saline aquifers. And there's quite a project in Illinois going on to look into this. And that's all great, but it needs to be accelerated. It needs to happen now because, you know, this problem is extraordinarily urgent. And I also think that for coal's future, this needs to happen quickly because other renewable energies like wind and at large-scale solar installations are coming down in price very quickly. And I think coal really needs to get serious about this if they're going to have a place at the table in the long term.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Well, that really is the central question here. We need the energy. We have this significant resource. Can technology be applied so that we can burn the coal, we can get the energy, and we can deal with the ameliorate the adverse environmental impact? I mean, is the technology? Is it a matter that we know how to do it? But then what we have to do is develop a kind of an infrastructure so that we can apply that? Or is it that the technology isn't quite there?
Well, you know, I think it's important to be clear, first of all, that even when you get to, like, the Future Gen plant that the caller was talking about or these coal gasification plants like I'm talking about, you still have tremendous problems with coal on the mining side. I mean, you know, that doesn't help the communities in Appalachia where, you know, they're seeing their mountains and their way of lives destroyed. So there's a whole range of impacts on the mining side that are an issue. In Illinois, they're trying to use a lot of the coal in a sort of mine-mouth way, building the plant essentially right on top of the coal. And in you know, that's a sort of much better to do it. It's cheaper. But there are still these, so there is the technology to do it, I think, on the burning end. These coal gasification plants, although they complain about them being a little bit more expensive and not quite as reliable, are really ready to go. And the sooner the industry gets to building them, I think the more viable their future will be. And the sooner we start burying carbon dioxide, which I think is undoubtedly, no question, the future for coal, the better their future will be also.
Let me quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in here the last 5 or 10 minutes, Jeff Goodell. He's a journalist. He's written a lot about the coal industry. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. And he is the author of the book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, published by Houghton Mifflin. The book first came out in hardcover in June of 2006, and then in April of it was already out in paper. It will be coming out in paperback shortly in April of this year, early April 2007. It'll be available in paper from the same publisher, Houghton Mifflin. So in any case, if you'd like to read the book, you can head to the library, head to the bookstore. I'm sure you can find it. Questions are welcome here too, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, that gets you to the question of what happens on the mining side, that if on the burning side we can do something with the technology to reduce its pollution, we still have the environmental impact of getting the coal out of the ground. If they're one of the important things for people in the industry and for coal as an energy source is the fact that it's cheap, and cheaper than oil and cheaper than natural gas and pretty much cheaper than anything else, how important there is the profit margin, and if you're talking about doing something different in the way of mining that's going to be more expensive, how difficult is it going to be to persuade the coal companies to do that? Because what that's going to mean, essentially, it's going to cut it into their profits if they're going to do something that's going to cost them more to get the coal out of the ground.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I think that it's important to point out that coal is cheap in the same sense that fast food is cheap. You can get a hamburger cheaper at a fast food joint than you can if you, go to a more conventional restaurant. But, you know, there's all of the health effects and problems that go along with, you know, a 100% fast food diet. It's similar to the problems in conceptualizing it with coal. I mean, coal is cheap, but mostly because we don't factor in the real costs of coal. The industry has used its political power to make sure that we don't, like the air pollution and the mining damages and things like that. But I think your question goes to the point about the future, because when we're talking about these coal gasification plants, when we're talking about burying carbon dioxide underground, when we're talking about safer mining practices and things like that, it's no question the cost of coal is going to go up. And there's no question that coal is no longer going to be cheap in the way that it is now. And so what happens then is you start to have to make a complicated decision. Do we really want to pay, you know, a lot more for coal and still have all of these problems? Or should we start shifting over towards other kinds of energy sources? Maybe wind looks a lot more appealing then. Large-scale solar installations look much more appealing. I was just out at Stanford University for a conference last week, and I was talking to some venture capitalists out there who are funding new energy projects, who are, you know, willing to fund whatever they think will make money. And one of them said to me, a very high-profile guy out there who controls a lot of money, you know, you have to be crazy to build a coal plant today because of the, you know, future risks of carbon and global warming and all kinds of productivity problems that coal could have, and that renewables are quickly gaining just into pure economics. Forget the whole environmental argument, just on the economic side. So I think that's an important part of it.
Mm. Well, I guess that leads, though, to the disturbing possibility that, at least in the meantime, we've got existing plants, we've got coal, we need the energy, older, dirtier plants, we're going to keep operating them because we can.
Well, you know, we certainly will, and the industry will keep fixing them up and keeping them running as long as possible. But, you know, there's a really unpredictable dynamic in this politically, in the sense of global warming and how quickly, you know, we will get serious about that and what the implications of that are economically for the coal industry and for existing plants. The world's top climatologist, this guy named Jim Hansen, who is at NASA, who's basically the kind of godfather of global warming science and very well respected on every level, you know, is basically arguing that in 10 or 15 years we're going to have to start bulldozing coal plants because they're such enormous sources of carbon dioxide and the problems and costs of dealing with carbon dioxide are going to become so great that any coal plant, existing or new, that doesn't bury carbon dioxide is going to be bulldozed. Mm.
Well, let's talk with some of the callers. Next up is someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I wondered if you could talk about longwall mining or what you thought about longwall mining and its effect on farmland and water. Here in Illinois, there's, actually Montgomery County, Illinois, near Litchfield to be exact, there's productive farmland and roads that are underwater currently because the areas have been longwall mined. I hear about global warming, but I hear little in the news about the specifics regarding the actual obtaining of the coal.
Yeah. I mean, longwall mining is a great example of the, you know, undiscussed consequences of our dependence on coal. I mean, it's easy to point to the mountaintop removal mines and show pictures of the devastation of those mines. But longwall mining is much more, in the big picture, subtle, but just as devastating for the communities who suffer from it.
Yeah, my understanding is longwall mining was pioneered in Germany, and they used a means where they dropped everything at once. So say you took out 5 feet of coal, you dropped the whole town 5 feet, and so there was little or no damage, whereas the longwall mining that's used here in the United States is one where you drop everything at an angle, and springs or sometimes don't flow anymore. Waterways go underground, or new waterways are formed. Houses or buildings that are above that area, of course, their foundations are cracked. Maybe their wells don't work anymore, or most likely they don't work anymore. And in Germany, longwall mining has been outlawed, but here it's still flourishing, and I think one reason it flourishes so well is because you can get the coal out so cheaply.
Right, and that's, as I was talking about before, increasingly, you know, a big issue, that especially in competing with these big open pit mines in Wyoming, it's the urgency of getting this coal out of the ground cheap, and if they can't do it cheaply, they can't do it. And, you know, there's the other thing is, the you know, from the miner safety point of view, longwall mines tend to be safer than the conventional room and pillar kind of mining, but it's really about economics. And you know, I think that these are the kinds of costs and consequences that have to be factored in to this idea that we're going to increase our reliance or even continue our reliance on coal.
Yeah, one reason it's so cheap, at least in Illinois, is the coal companies have usurped coal rights that were sold in the late 1800s, early 1900s for prices at that time, and they have, in some cases, usurped them from local governments and are going in and taking out more coal under the auspices of longwall mining, which I think it's unclear when those coal rights were bought that was really an option.
Right, right. There's all kinds of issues like this with mining, with, you know, severance taxes, also with rights, with ownership. It's a really complicated thing, and as you probably know, it's going to get more complicated because, you know, the simple, easy to get coal is,
well, I certainly hope it does get more complicated for the rights of the citizens.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on next to someone in Danville, line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Great discussion. I was going to ask the question, but I guess I'll just make a comment now. Speaking of longwall mining, the Vermilion County, anything south of 74 is really a suspect area to build. The gentleman from Belgium down there knows this well, that the mine sinks that are now beginning to occur from the old mines that existed, the pillar shaft mines that are just honeycomb throughout the Vermain County area. And I'm wondering, is there any kind of research or analysis that's been done of economic development, long-term costs in subsidence, this type of thing? Has there been anything done along those lines?
You mean long-term costs and the consequences to the community of this stuff?
Correct. You know, for instance, for years, Tilton has been trying, which is a community just south of Danville on the south side of 74, has been trying to get a Walmart or a Target or someone to come in. But, you know, that area, any company with any, you know, any research at all is going to look at it and say, well, we can't build a monstrous building on this site because part of it may drop 5 feet in some point in the future.
Yeah. I think, again, great, you know, perspective on the not enough discussed consequences of coal mining. And I'm not aware of any studies that look at the economic consequences for a region specifically about longwall mining and the issues around longwall mining, like some subsidence and water problems. They try to do that kind of thing. They've done a number of studies like that in that I'm aware of in West Virginia, trying to look at it from a for the mountaintop removal mining and the problems there. But you know, frankly, it's difficult to get these kinds of studies done because you know the political establishment in many of these coal communities is very much against this kind of a study. It's very difficult for universities to get funding for them. And it's really something that, you know, in many cases, the powers that be don't want to talk about. And so, it's left undiscussed and unstudied.
Right. Yeah, that's probably very true. Also, you're talking about a lot of intangibles. You know, these mine sinks that you can actually see down through Belgium and Westville and that and Georgetown, you know, these are from mines that have been closed for 20, 30, 50 years in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's really tough. You know, you're looking at long-term calculations as well.
Right, right. I mean, you know, in Pennsylvania, I spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania looking at some of this. And, you know, they have a sort of joke, half joke out there that the entire state is held up by mining timbers, you know, that you know, everywhere. The number of abandoned mines in places like the regions of Illinois you're talking about or in Pennsylvania and West Virginia is really enormous. I mean, there's, you know, the entire states are essentially honeycombed underneath. And it has big impacts on, especially on water, besides the subsidence problems.
Right, yeah. And isn't somewhere out there, don't they have a problem with, like, the mines being on fire, have been for, like, decades?
And in Centralia, Pennsylvania, there's been underground fires there. The whole town essentially has been burned up by this underground mine. And, you know, once the coal underground catches fire, it's virtually impossible to put it out. They try various ways of smothering it and things. But, you know, there have been underground fires that have been burning for, you know, 100 years.
Interesting.
And there's nothing they can do about it, essentially.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Let's go next to line number 2. This is back here in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like to go back for a moment to a comment you made previously when you referred to Futuregen and coal gasification. You seem to separate the two as two different programs or processes, if you will, whereas Futuregen actually is a demonstration of coal with a gasification, the difference, I think, being that Futuregen is going to both potentially provide hydrogen as an off-site fuel, either for fuel cells or other utilization, and it has the sequestration technology fully built into it. I think one of the things that, and you mentioned also that we need to move these kinds of technologies forward more promptly. I totally agree. But when you're faced with a federal budget situation in terms of research and so forth, that is often appropriated on a year-to-year basis, it's really difficult sometimes to move or conceptualize a multi-year program together. Futuregen is to come online in 2012, assuming it goes forward and it continues to get the support that it deserves. I would also point out that as far as sequestration is concerned, we've got a tremendous amount of research going on here at the Illinois State Geological Survey on that topic in concert with the geosurveys of the surrounding states. And we are actively looking at particularly the reliability and the safety of that. So while we need these technologies now, at the same time, it's extremely important that we proceed in a measured and deliberate pace so that we know that if we are to attempt carbon sequestration, we should make sure that it's going to be safe and that it's going to work. One final thought with regard to renewables versus coal. I think the answer there all too often in the public dialogue winds up being an either-or. But when you look at the projected growth rate of electric usage in this country over the next couple of decades, you consider the role that both coal, that new coal technologies, coal gasification integrated with carbon sequestration can play. I think there's a role for all of the wind, all of the solar, all of the renewables that we can potentially muster in addition to the advanced use of coal in a clean way. Don't forget that there are places in the country where the private sector has attempted to build, for example, windmill farms, and there's been a lot of local opposition simply on the basis of the, I don't want to look at those things. So there's two-edged swords to everything as far as that goes.
Right. Well, that, those are all very intelligent comments, and I agree more or less with everything you said. I certainly think that it's not an either-or situation. But I think that with coal, I mean, the problem is that we're throwing up a lot of coal plants right now that are not using this new technology, that are not carbon capture ready. Carbon capture, I was just out at Stanford last week talking with people about that. I mean, I believe it can work on a limited scale. I'm not yet convinced that, you know, it's going to be this sort of silver bullet. But I know that in Illinois there's a lot of sites that can work for it, and they're doing a lot of good studies out there. But you know, the train is roaring down the tracks here, and I think that the urgency of getting this stuff studied and deployed it can't be overstated.
Well, I think I agree with you 100%, and I think there are two thoughts on that. With regard to the plants being built, for example, the TXU controversy in Texas, potentially, although apparently not all those will now be built because of the private sector takeover of TXU. But the point is that we have to, if we are going to do this effectively, we have to have a national will to say, yes, this is going to happen. Because if we do that, if we have, for example, a national cap-and-trade system on CO2, we will put all these plants on a common basis, and all of a sudden it will be in their interest to move forward with that. So at the same time that we proceed on the research, we've got to have these two lines going in parallel, a public policy line and a research line.
I agree. I mean, the best thing that could happen to, you know, the American energy debate right now, in my view, is a serious cap-and-trade program. I mean, that would begin to change the dynamics for all of this stuff.
Right, absolutely. And it would foster it, and it would put everybody on notice that this is where we're going. And I think at that point in time, the political will to support the research on an ongoing basis, make sure we can do it with the least cost to the ratepayer while protecting the environment, I think those kinds of considerations will come together.
Right, right. And I mean, that's one of the conclusions I came to after spending, you know, a number of years working on my book, is that for all this talk about new technology and things, this is really a political problem more than a technological problem. Once we get the will to say, you know, we're going to deal with this problem, we're putting a tax or a cap and trade or whatever your, you know, price, however you want to arrange this, a significant price on carbon dioxide emissions, then, you know, a lot of innovation will flower. I was just, like I mentioned earlier, was in Silicon Valley last week, and these venture capitalists are, you know, saying, you know, as soon as we get a serious price on carbon, it's going to be a flowering of innovation, because we know that we can't continue the old way. But you know, one of the problems with the coal industry is they've been the leaders in fighting and delaying this, and they've been undermining this for years and exploiting every loophole, and you know, they bear a lot of responsibility for this.
I really appreciate the comments of the caller. I have some other folks I want to get to, and we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with journalist Jeff Goodell. He's written a lot about coal. He is the author of the book Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, a book that was published by Houghton Mifflin in hardcover not very long ago, and will be coming out soon in paper, same publisher, if you want to read read it. Just to make sure people understand, when you talk about capping and trading emissions, we're talking about there is essentially setting limits on how much people can emit, but also making it possible for two, say you've got two power plants, two generators, and one is emitting a lot of carbon dioxide and the other is not very much, that what you can do is the one that emits the less, you can sell your, in a sense, sell your ability to emit to somebody else, so that what you're doing is that you're trading. You have a permit to emit so much, you can trade those back and forth. And what happens is that means, though, overall what you're doing is you're putting a limit on how much carbon dioxide can be released by everybody. And then you're creating also an incentive either for one guy to limit his, or that's actually something that he can actually trade and make some money if somebody else decides that they can't or they won't. Is that essentially the basic idea?
Well, very well put.
Okay. Let us talk with someone in Clark County, line one. Hello.
Hello. No one has mentioned, but while I've listened to the program, geothermal. I don't know much about it, except I know it's expensive. But I do know of a school that is on geothermal and some private homes. Is that a speakable alternative at all?
Well, it's interesting. There, I have to say, I haven't had a chance to read this study, but there was just recently a study published by, and now I can't even remember who did the study, but it was a very significant study that just came out about geothermal and talking about the tremendous potential for it and that relatively cost effective. And I think geothermal is a great example of the kind of innovation that will start to happen and the way people will start to think differently once we do what we talked about with the earlier caller, which is putting a price on carbon, getting away from this notion that we can just have this sort of eternal supply of cheap energy from coal or whatever other source, and begin to really deal with the limits that that global warming, especially, as well as rising energy prices of all sorts, will put on things. And so I think geothermal, the short answer is, has a tremendous possibility, both on small scale for individual homes, but also on large scale also.
Good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's talk with next someone in Champaign, line three. Hello.
Hi. You guys have been talking about longwall mining, but I don't know what it is. In Pittsburgh, they have things called shoring rights, where they'll leave a column of coal, and then when they exhaust the seam, they'll back out of the mine and remove that pillar, and suddenly the ground will collapse. Is that the same thing, or what exactly is longwall mining?
Yeah, it's different than what you're talking about. You're talking about what I hear commonly. It was commonly referred to in the mining business as room and pillar mining, which is traditional underground mining where they leave the essentially coal pillars up to hold the roof up while they mine, and then they take those pillars out when they've got to the end of the mine. They then take the pillars out, and the mine kind of collapses as they take it out, and it's a very old-fashioned and quite dangerous and kind of hairy coal mining. The guys who do it are amazing people. I've met some of them, because it's essentially you're underground in a controlled collapse. Longwall mining is a different beast entirely. Longwall mining usually happens with thick seams of coal above, say, 7 or 8 feet, 9 feet. It's essentially a big machine, like a big cutter, that rolls along this long wall back and forth, like it's completely automated, computer controlled, that cuts these large seams of coal, and is very efficient at doing it. And they can only operate in conditions where the geology is just right, where the coal is thick enough, where the seam is wide enough that they can set this machine up. And it's essentially this sort of big like cutter that will get the coal out of the ground very efficiently with very little manpower.
Thank you.
All right, very good. I thank you for the call. We'll continue. And the next person here is in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, are there other countries that are doing a better job in developing clean coal technology? or are they following the same mistakes we've made?
That's a great question, and I'd have to say that no, they're following the same mistakes we've made. I mean, the country that comes to mind that's trying to do things, I think, the most is Germany. They are very progressive about their energy policies. They are trying various advanced coal technology, including one called oxygen firing, where they burn the coal in pure oxygen, which makes it much easier to capture the carbon dioxide. But they're also shifting very quickly to renewables. They're the biggest solar energy. They create more solar energy in Germany than anywhere else. They have a lot of subsidies and things to push renewables. In fact, they've been in the news recently about the EU is trying to determine how much renewables they're going to commit to, and Germany's been the leader in that. So the short answer is, I think that, you know, no one's really doing much of a better job. I think it's an issue everywhere, and I think it's particularly an issue here because we are, as the coal industry likes to say, the Saudi Arabia of coal. And I think that for America, coming to terms with our energy needs, both at a time of rising oil prices and maybe even peak oil, where we begin to get a dwindling supply of global oil, in addition to global warming, is going to put a lot of pressure on coal and on doing it right. And if we want to have sort of really any hope of managing global warming to a level that what scientists tell us gives us a reasonable chance to avoid radically destabilizing the climate, we have to get a handle on coal, and that's why this conversation is so important.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. One of the things I want to make sure that we talk about here is the issue of mine safety, that is the safety of miners. I talked about the fact that we, last time we talked, and this actually was, I think, before Big Coal was even published, we talked about the Sago mine disaster. This was just right at the beginning of 2006 in West Virginia. There was an explosion. 12 miners were killed. One man survived. And then over the next few months, last year, there were more than 30 more coal miners died on the job. It was apparently one of the worst years in a decade or more for coal miners in the United States. And at the time, there were calls for improving regulations under which the mines operate and providing greater safety for coal miners. What is happening with mine safety, and in fact, have things improved?
Well, last year was a deadly year. I think 47 miners were killed, and it was the most in more than a decade, but it's even more sort of depressing than that in a way, because the number of underground miners has fallen since the last couple of decades quite radically. So when you look at it really as a kind of per capita rate, it's even higher than those numbers would suggest. Whether it's gotten better or not, you know, that's a very tough question to answer. I mean, there have been a number of regulatory improvements. There have been requirements to have better air canisters for miners underground, various other regulatory protections. But when you talk to people in the mining industry, they really will tell you that not much has really changed. And this is the story of coal mining, as they kind of careen from tragedy to tragedy. And only when there's a tragedy does the attention get focused on it. And I think this is going to be a bigger issue moving forward because, as I mentioned briefly earlier, we've been mining coal in America for 150 years, and all of the sort of easy-to-get coal is gone. And the stuff that we're going after now is getting increasingly deeply buried, increasingly complex to go after. And so, you know, having tough safety guidelines for this is going to become really important in the future. And I don't see big changes, really. I think it's changes at the margins here.
Several other callers. We'll try to get as many as we can. Next is Champagne Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to take exception to your description of longwall mining. I think room and pillar mining, the difference is they leave a lot more coal up above, and so In general, it doesn't collapse. Sometimes it does collapse. Longwall mining, they take virtually everything out, and then the idea is to collapse it behind them as they go. And as it collapses, it cracks everything above, and it drops to land based on what's above and how much coal is taken out. So there are areas, for example, in bottom land that are now lakes. There are areas where farmland are lakes, and there are areas where springs no longer flow because of the cracking of the soil above. And that's not in the news, and I don't understand why.
Right. I mean, I certainly didn't mean to leave out the fact that
it's devastating.
Longwall mining has much more environmental impacts than
and not only that, they pull the coal out at around $1 a ton, and so it's cheap energy to produce ethanol. It takes more energy to produce that ethanol than we can get out of it when we burn it. And what's the point?
Right. Well, I was certainly glad you brought that up. I mean, the idea of burning coal to create ethanol is probably one of the dumbest ideas in energy and anywhere in the world, and we are doing that today. There's a couple of coal to ethanol plants that I'm aware of going up in Minnesota and in other places, and that really is the height of sort of idiotic energy usage. If we continue down that road, we're in real big trouble in lots of ways. But, you know, longwall mining it should be talked about more. And it's just one of those things that, like also coal combustion wastes. You know, when you burn coal, there's ash, essentially, and that ash gets buried in these ponds that then leach heavy metals into aquifers and are a big public health problem. There was a National Academy of Science study that came out last year that's talking about this, and it's another big consequence of burning coal that never gets talked about, and I don't quite know why that is. It's partly because people have only so much attention span, but I think I applaud people like you for calling and bringing it out, because that's the way it's going to get talked about.
Yeah, again, I want to thank the caller. I want to get one more here in Urbana, line 3. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 3? In Urbana?
Oh, yes. First of all, thanks for the show. Very informative and great discussion from your guest and from the callers. I really just wanted to mention and put in a plug that we have right here in town one of the premier research agencies in the country and in the world in the Illinois State Geological Survey, and they're coincidentally having an open house today until 3 and also tomorrow 10 to 2. It's in the Natural Resources Building on the South Quad of the U of I campus. And there's researchers at the ISGS on this coal gasification, coal to liquids, and geological sequestration. And you can talk to the scientists leading that research and learn about it and see demonstrations. I would encourage anyone who's interested in learning more to head down.
All right. Very good.
Thanks.
Let me ask you, Jeff, one further question about this coal to liquids issue. What do you think about the possibility of the taking the coal and turning it into diesel?
Well, you know, it's an idea that's getting a lot of attention now because it's the one way that coal can really begin to displace oil, and the coal industry would really like this to happen, and so would a lot of investors and coal boosters. And economically, I think that, you know, as long as oil stays above $40 or $45 a barrel, you can do it economically. The big problem with this is, well, there's two. One is the sort of whole notion that we can simply displace oil by coal. These plants are tremendously expensive. They cost billions of dollars, and we're not going to scale them up quickly enough to make a huge difference. But the other big problem is that they are very CO2 and carbon dioxide intensive. They create roughly twice as much carbon dioxide as refining petroleum does, and unless we sequester, bury that carbon dioxide, they're really a disaster going forward with dealing with global warming. And whenever you hear about coal to liquids, you have to ask, are they going to sequester or bury this carbon dioxide? And if so, is that included in the price that you're talking about, you know, how cheap this is?
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've come to the end of the time. Again, our guest this morning, Jeff Goodell. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone, frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. If you'd like to read his book, it's Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It's still available in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin, and next month will be coming out in paper by the same publisher. Mr. Goodell, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.